Yes, unfortunately. I mean, one doesn't like to be confirmed in these kinds of very negative assessments of the prevailing political attitudes that seem to be sufficiently respectable to not interfere with someone like McCain's qualifications to be our next president. And it contrasts with the kinds of truth-telling that has gone on in Barack Obama's church that he had to repudiate in order to retain his credibility.
That is very strange, isn't it? I mean, McCain is practically, you know, slavering at the mouth, and, you know, he's a psychotic killer. There are some photographs of him you can Google up on the web with horrific grimaces. You know, he looks like the kind of person you should lock up. And these kinds of statements that he, you know, that hatred is so wonderful because it helps him do these you know, mass murderous kinds of activities. And this is a qualification to be president? There's something wrong here.
Yes, there's something disastrously wrong, and it's a very chilling insight, I believe, into the deeper problems of our culture, that we would not repudiate such ideas in a way that would make someone like McCain ashamed to be associated with such ideas. But we don't do that. And so it's not only McCain, it's the cultural environment that sustains these sorts of attitudes and repudiates efforts to expose the truth, such as what we were talking about, 9/11, or the truths of the way in which war has been conducted in genocidal patterns in the past. All of that has to be kept under control. We can't even really approach what was done at Hiroshima and Nagasaki more than 50 years ago, because it still would require us to acknowledge that we did something that was disastrously wrong and immoral and really should have been treated as a war crime.
And sometimes I ask myself to what extent that cultural failing that you've just described is a natural sort of human response that is just contingent, and to what extent it's actually being controlled or manipulated. You know, Edward Bernays, Sigmund Freud's nephew, invented the so-called science of public relations, which is really a science of mind control, mass-produced mind control, which has been perfected over the decades in many, many different ways, to the extent that unconscious manipulation of the mass mind is now the order of our society. And I wonder whether this problem is perhaps more attributable to the manipulation of elites who have highly skilled techniques for manipulating public opinion rather than a failing in human nature.
Well, I think it's some of both. I mean, I do think that the manipulative techniques certainly accentuate the problem, but I do think that under certain conditions, a political culture can be more or less attuned to moral imperatives. I think a country that's been badly defeated in war, such as Germany was forced to confront its own past in ways that allowed it to move forward, to move on. Unfortunately, the U.S. has never really had to deal with that kind of defeat, and we've been able to keep the skeletons we have locked in the closet. But that means those skeletons still exert a strong influence and prevent us from coping in a proper way with the challenges that are posed at the present time.
We certainly do have some skeletons, including the African-American slave trade Holocaust, the Native American Holocaust, and a long history of aggressive and brutal warfare. it seems to me that the McCain quotes that you so presciently dredged up for that 2001 article, Vietnam Syndrome, make me think of the kind of manipulation of people to turn them into killers that's described in Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman's book, On Killing. He points out that after World War II, studies were done showing that only a small minority, about 15 to 20%, of infantry soldiers would actually shoot to kill. The rest would either not fire their weapons or purposely miss. And further, archaeological research showed this was probably the case in previous wars as well. They then instituted a Pavlovian conditioning scheme to radically dehumanize the enemy, trigger instinctive hatred to the point that soldiers would kill just automatically. And they got it up to a 50% kill rate in Korea and a 90% kill rate in Vietnam. That is, 90% of Vietnam soldiers would actually try to kill the enemy. And the result was a flood of badly damaged veterans. And it does seem to me that this kind of inculcation of hatred is partly a scientific program of military social scientists.
Yes, I mean, I think there's no question that that is part of the picture. And I think that we need to recognize the degree to which we have been conditioned to behave in this way. At the same time, I do think that there is sufficient freedom within our own mental geography to find alternative paths that are not as beholden to this conditioning. I would hate to think that we are so entrapped in these webs of deceit and essentially homicidal behavior that we have no hope of ever escaping.
Well, I would hate to think that too. And the fact that people like Lieutenant Colonel Grossman are able to break out of their conditioning and think about it and deconstruct it gives me some hope. We'll come back to talk some more in a few moments with Richard Falk. Stick around. Well, Richard, you know, you're doing some of the most important work on the planet right now in many ways, and in particular, your discussion of nuclear nonproliferation and the possibility for disarming is clearly a major task set before humanity. You know, along with Dave Grossman's book that I was discussing earlier, which shows us that human nature has a strong barrier against killing members of our own species, which is a very hopeful sign. the other military book that has influenced me the most is Gwyn Dyer's book, War, which he wrote as an accompaniment to a Canadian documentary way back, maybe a couple of decades ago at least. And Gwyn Dyer organizes his book about the history of warfare as really our movement towards having to come to grips with our choice. Are we going to eliminate these massive weapons that we've developed, or are they going to eliminate us? And, Richard, you've written about the non-proliferation treaty and non-proliferation issues. You've pointed out the problems with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, and called for a new replacement, a nuclear disarmament treaty, in a treaty establishing an international sustainable energy agency. Can you describe that proposal and tell us why that's so important?
Yes, sure. I mean, I think that the whole idea of nuclear nonproliferation was based on the illusion that the nuclear weapon states could somehow retain what it thought to be the benefits of these weapons of mass destruction and yet deny them to the rest of the world. And it did promise to engage in nuclear disarmament negotiations, which is part of the NPT regime, but it's never really upheld that promise. And so what the non-proliferation approach has been is to allow the dominant states in the world, mainly the U.S. and to some extent the former Soviet Union, Russia now, to build these incredible arsenals of thousands of nuclear weapons. And they are gradually spreading to the rest of the world. They'll gradually be available to non-state actors as well. And they create a situation where sooner or later, these weapons will be used again and used in a way that will produce terrible results. There is an alternative, and that alternative is to abolish these weapons and to make an unconditional commitment to get rid of them responsibly and by stages, have an inspection system that accompanies the disarmament process. And there are risks, of course, that there will be cheating and there will be a revival of the nuclear weapons capabilities by some of these states. But it's the best risk we can take at the present time if we're to have any hope at all of escaping from this destiny that really does cast a dark shadow across the future of humanity. And besides that, as E.P. Thompson and others have pointed out long ago, a country that prepares to wage a war of annihilation, which nuclear weapons imply, has itself made a terrible Faustian bargain with really evil, destructive forces, because there's no way that these weapons can be used except as weapons to annihilate innocent civilian populations, destroy cities, destroy culture, destroy everything that's valuable in the human experience. And for us to be unable to even contemplate getting rid of these weapons is a sign of our own alienation from the better side of human nature.
It certainly is. Indeed, the history of the pretense that nuclear weapons could be used strategically and in a limited fashion is a sort of a dark comedy in and of itself. And it's interesting that the people who are involved in policymaking never seem to realize what a dark comedy they're caught up in until they retire. And you point out that four people that I never would have expected to be calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons, that's Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, William Perry, and Sam Nunn, are on board with this. Kissinger being the arch realist, and some would say war criminal, Shultz being called the godfather of the neocons by some people out there, and then Sam Nunn, of course, is a defense kind of politician, you know, big military budget kind of guy. It's interesting that people like these guys are actually in agreement that we need to work towards the abolition of nuclear weapons.
Yes. I mean, I think on the one side, it's hopeful because it suggests that people who've devoted their whole lives to supporting the nuclear weapons establishment, Kissinger basically made his reputation by saying that limited nuclear weapons were a viable possibility for the U.S. during the Cold War, have now come to the opposite conclusion, that the security and success of the United States in a global setting depends on getting rid of these weapons as soon as possible. The disturbing element is that even with heavyweights of this sort, the nuclear weapons establishment is so powerful that their voices are basically unheard. And this, despite the fact that they've published these views twice in the Wall Street Journal, and still there's hardly any effort to say, well, if people like this think we should be getting rid of nuclear weapons, shouldn't we at least as a society and a government think seriously about moving in this direction?
There are some clues that the post 9/11 situation may have something to do with nuclear proliferation. You know, as you know, my take on things is that 9/11 seems to me to have been proved to have been an inside job. You know, seven ways from Sunday. So that's kind of the framework I'll apply here. It looks to me as though one of the possible motivations for 9/11, besides the aggressive imperialism that's followed it, is perhaps these people are actually afraid of a world of nuclear proliferation in which non-state actors get a hold of immensely destructive weapons. And perhaps they're trying to sort of immunize the country by way of an inoculation on 9/11, an apparently massive attack that's actually doing, you know, doing New York City good economically by taking down a white elephant and so on and so forth. We'll talk a little more about that in a moment when we come back. This is a conversation between me, Kevin Barrett, and Richard Falk, the international relations specialist. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
There's a guy named Randy Glass, who was an FBI informant, who knew that the Twin Towers were going to be destroyed. He learned that many months before 9/11, and he got more and more clues. He was eventually given the phone number of Francis Taylor, a high-level State Department counterterror operative, a protege of Colin Powell's. And he called that private number, and Francis Taylor answered and said, "Randy, you can't say anything about the planes that are going to hit the World Trade Towers. We are tiptoeing through a nuclear minefield now. You must not discuss this with anyone, including your colleagues." And then that conversation happened in August of 2001, according to Randy Glass, who has been considered a reliable source by a number of mainstream television shows, but they never want to put that quote front and center. Well, this quote and many other similar clues lead me to suspect, Richard, that among the many motivations for 9/11, this tiptoeing through a nuclear minefield quote sort of thing suggests to me that the fear of non-state actors getting nuclear weapons, perhaps suitcase bombs and similar things, may have led the powers that be to think that we need to do an all-out attack against quote-unquote al-Qaeda and other non-state actors. In other words, just really ramp up the so-called, you know, anti-terror action and you know, pull out all the stops and so on and so forth. And, you know, if so, that policy certainly doesn't look to be a very good long-term one. As you've argued in many places, it makes sense to get rid of the weapons rather than to, you know, have an all-out war to see who can control them, which is, of course, going to just get worse and worse. But the problem from the other standpoint, you know, these so-called realists might say, look, we've already got who knows how many hundreds of suitcase weapons floating around out there, some of them perhaps for sale. How are we really going to get rid of these things?
You unearthed things that I had forgotten about, actually. But I think that the mindset of these kinds of people deep in the bureaucracy is hard for me to understand. I mean, because if they really thought that the way to get at the problems of non-state actors was to simulate this kind of attack, it seems to me that it was the worst possible strategy just from a tactical point of view. It was a good strategy if the idea was to wake up the American people to some exaggerated fear and a sense of threat that would allow their mobilization for war. But we were already spending as much on our military capabilities as the rest of the world combined. And we certainly had a capability to go after and detect and deal with non-state actors that were seeking this kind of weaponry. What we did by responding the way we have to 9/11, I think, is to create a much stronger set of incentives to move in precisely that direction. So if this thinking really is accurate, an accurate description of the pre-9/11 mindset, it shows how dysfunctional, from a security perspective, our government has become. And it's depressing on both levels, both because it should be so deceptive and depressing because it's so out of touch with reality.
What can you leave our listeners with as far as a suggestion about what they could do to contribute to moving the world towards a more peaceful and sustainable path?
I think it is imperative that citizens of this country who have a concern for the future do come to grips with what happened on 9/11, because if that official version can be repudiated and our situation much more clearly illuminated, I think it could give rise to the sort of political movement that we need if we're to face the kind of challenges from climate change to the war system that are making it seem as if the future will be such a dismal experience for our children and grandchildren.
That was the voice of international law expert, Professor Richard Falk of Princeton University, speaking with Dr. Kevin Barrett on March 24th on his Dynamic Duo radio program. Kevin Barrett hosts several radio shows devoted to the issues surrounding 9/11 truth. For a schedule of his shows and upcoming guests and to find out how you can hear them, go to the Muslim, Jewish, and Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth at mujca.com, M-U-J-C-A.com, and look for the link to Kevin Barrett's radio programs. We'll return now to the testimony from Winter Soldier.
Thank you all for being here. My name is Camilo Mejia. I joined the military in 1995 as an infantryman. And I deployed to the Middle East in March of 2003, first to Jordan and then to Iraq in April of that same year. The beginning of my friction with the chain of command in my unit began before we actually deployed to the Middle East, when I made the decision that as an infantry squad leader, I was no longer going to physically punish the men under my command, and that I would no longer yell at them, but that I would instead establish a relationship based on respect. And that didn't sit too well with my platoon leader or my platoon sergeant at the time, because they felt like an infantry leader has to inject high levels of testosterone into his leadership style, and that in order to get your men to follow you and to respect you, you have to lower them to the level of your boots and humiliate them. And I started by saying that because I want people to know that the dehumanization and the disrespect and the humiliation that we are bestowing upon the people of Iraq does not begin in Iraq. It's not the result. It's not the result of people waking up one morning as monsters, but it's part of the culture. It's part of the military culture. They train us that way. And given the environment that we find ourselves in, all kinds of things that under normal circumstances would seem impermissible and objectionable become basically the norm. Because of the change in my leadership style, I was transferred from the platoon that I deployed to the Middle East with, which was 3rd Platoon. I was transferred to 2nd Platoon, but I retained my position as a squad leader, so I was still in charge of an infantry squad. As a squad leader, I had two team leaders under my command, and one of the people who has served under my leadership in the 1st Platoon that I served in, which was 3rd Platoon, got into a firefight. That platoon got into a firefight, and after the firefight, when they left the area, they were being tailgated by this Iraqi. And he fired at him and hit him in the chest. And another firefight was triggered from that. And the man was not able to receive treatment for about 2 or 3 hours, and then he was medevaced from the area. About 2 weeks after that incident, I remember that they needed someone to drive the vehicle that this man had been in when he was shot, because the relatives were at the gate. and they wanted their car back. So they asked me to drive it because I was the only person around who knew how to drive a stick. So I drove the car back to the ECP, the entry control point, and ran into this person who fired at him and who hit him in the chest, who had been one of the team leaders under my command in 3rd Platoon and who had been a very good friend of mine. And he said, "He's here." And I said, "Who is here?" And he said, "The man I shot." And I looked, and indeed he was there, and he had like a zipper-like scar on his chest. And this person looked at me and he said, "I know it's messed up, but I can't help feeling like I got cheated because that was my one confirmed kill. And now he's here alive." And he realized what he was saying was wrong, but he couldn't help it. He couldn't help feeling that way. He couldn't help feeling that the fact that he did not take a human life actually reflected poorly on him. Later, during our deployment, my platoon was tasked with the quick reaction force task. So we basically had to respond to any attacks that happened to any of the units operating in the area. And we received this call. The 1st Platoon had actually encountered some resistance during a raid. They had kicked down a door and gone inside of a house and taken chase after these two men. And then another one of our soldiers went into the house after them and saw that there was a brother of the two men coming out with an AK-47, and he shot him. So by the time we got there, there was really not much to be done other than secure the perimeter. And after that, we basically were tasked with transporting the two men who had been captured. I believe one was the cousin of the dead and the other one was the brother. And we were basically guarding these two men, and we were guarding the body of the dead. And when we got to our base, we had to transfer the body from the 5-ton truck that we had into a Humvee because the truck that we had was too big to fit through the gate of the hospital to get to the morgue. So they pulled the body by the feet and dropped it on the ground in front of the two relatives that were there, and everyone began laughing. And the shroud came off, and the same soldier who had been a team leader in my squad began laughing, and he said, "Oh, they really screwed you up, didn't they?" Of course, the language he used was much stronger, but don't worry, I won't say the word. And he just kept making fun of this incident, and then he stuck his hand in his cargo pocket and pulled out a disposable camera and threw it at someone. He said, "Take a picture of me and this mother." And he started posing with the body. And I just could not conciliate the person that I had served with in Jordan and who had been so close to me, and the person who was there basically posing with this dead Iraqi person in front of his family. The first mission that we had when we got to Iraq was at this place called Al-Asad, and our job there was basically to run a prisoner of war camp. And at this prisoner of war camp, our job was basically to keep prisoners who have been deemed enemy combatants sleep deprived for periods of up to 72 hours in order to, quote unquote, soften them up for interrogation. And the way we did that was by yelling at them. So my first question to the people who were training us on how to do this was, you know, how do they understand? I mean, they don't speak English. And he said, "Well, they're just like animals. They're just like dogs. If you keep yelling at them, it doesn't matter what language you're yelling at them in, they're going to get the point. If you yell at them, get up enough times, you know, just like a dog gets up, they'll get up. If you tell them to move left, eventually they'll get it and they'll move left." And they said, "But that's not going to always work because they're so tired." By the way, they were hooded with sandbags and they were tied with plastic restraints, barefoot, and circled around with concertina wire. So they were not only being deprived of sleep, but also of light and a sense of space. So the next thing that we did was to hit the wall next to them with a sledgehammer to create this explosion-like sound to scare them. And when that didn't work, the next step was to put a gun to their heads and to charge it as if to execute him. Basically, we were performing mock executions to scare this man. And every now and then that wouldn't work, so you would grab the person who was not obeying and put him in a chamber and hit the wall next to this person to basically drive him insane and get them to obey. Another time, I remember we were at a traffic control point and we had received reports of ambulances being used to deliver explosives. So we were really close to the only, we were actually blocking the only road that led to the hospital, to the local hospital, and this ambulance came upon our traffic control point and they told us that we could not let the ambulance through. There was a pregnant woman who needed to get to the hospital, but they said, we don't know if that's a pregnant woman or if this is, you know, a van, you know, full of explosives and it's going to explode. So we basically turned it back. And I remember at the time I felt bad and I wanted to send a team to basically to search the van and to establish whether it was there really was a pregnant woman. But I kept thinking of the images of the ambulance exploding in the perimeter and killing a bunch of our people. So I basically made the decision not to search the van and to just turn it away. Another time, we were again at a traffic control point, and we were attacked, and we were in the middle of a firefight, and then they stopped shooting at us, and we began to assess the damage and to, you know, collect our wounded, and there were a lot of Iraqi civilians who were killed. And from this car came a voice that was calling me, "Mister, Mister," and I approached the car, and again, we had this intel report saying that at traffic control points, you know, people will call you and say, you know, help me, and then they'll shoot you or they'll the vehicle will blow up. So when I'm approaching this car, and right after this firefight, and then after this happened, and they began shooting at us again. But as I approached this car, I saw that there was this man, this young man at the driver's seat, and that there were two older gentlemen who were also wounded, one pretty badly, and who were saying, you know, help me, help me. And at the time, I could all I could think about was that intel report saying, you know, these people are trying to kill you. So I basically had my rifle aimed at them, and I was about to shoot him until somebody came and said, "Sergeant, Sergeant, you know, they're wounded. Don't shoot at them." But I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's really it's almost impossible to act upon your morality in a situation like that when you have been fed all this information that, you know, these people are out there to kill you. And what you do is you basically remove the humanity from them to make it easier to oppress them, to brutalize them, to beat them. And in doing so, you remove the humanity from yourself because you cannot act as a human being and do all of these things. And one last incident that I want to talk about was the first time that I opened fire on a human being, and this happened right after a protest. They were throwing grenades at us, and they said, you know, if anybody throws a grenade, you know, you open fire on them. So we saw this coming, and I saw this young man, basically, you know, his arm was swinging, and he had a black object in his hand, which was indeed a grenade. And I remember seeing all of this through the rear aperture of my M16 rifle sight, and I remember when we opened fire on him. And then I remember when two men came from the crowd and basically dragged them by his shoulders back into the crowd after we killed them. And after that incident, I remember going into a room by myself and counting the rounds that I had left in my magazine, and I had 19 rounds left, which meant that I had fired 11 rounds at this person, and but yet I had no recollection of hitting him or him going down, him dropping, him dying. There's this blank space in my memory, which is a blank space that I have for other experiences, like this time when this child was basically riding in the passenger seat with his father, and we decapitated his father with a machine gun. And when we went down to the low ground to search for enemy wounded, I remember seeing this young person standing next to his body that was decapitated. And when I think about it, I cannot remember the expression on the child's face. I cannot remember that it was a child. I only know this because people told me later on that was the man's son, the man's young son who was standing next to the body. And it's because not only it's not enough to to dehumanize the enemy by means of your military background or training or the indoctrination or the heat and the fatigue and the intensity of the environment. But there are times when it is so hard to deal with these experiences that I suppose your own body, your own psyche, in order to protect you from these memories and in order to protect you from losing your humanity, erases certain memories that are too painful to deal with, that are too overwhelming to deal with. And whether it is to punish the men in your squad or the men in your unit or to erase the face of a child whose father was decapitated next to him in a car at a traffic control point, or whether it is to pose next to a dead civilian or Iraqi or whoever, it is necessary to become dehumanized, because war is dehumanizing. And we have a whole new generation. We have over 1 million Iraqi dead. We have over 5 million Iraqis displaced. We have close to 4,000 dead. We have close to 60,000 injured, both by combat injuries and non-combat injuries coming back from this war. And that's not even counting the post-traumatic stress disorder and all the other psychological and emotional scars that our generation is bringing home with them. So all that just to say that war is dehumanizing a whole new generation of this country and destroying the people in the country of Iraq. In order for us to reclaim our humanity as a military and as a country, we demand the immediate and unconditional withdrawal of all troops from Iraq, care and benefits for all veterans, and reparations for the Iraqi people so they can rebuild their country on their terms. Thank you for standing with Iraq Veterans Against the War.
That's the voice of Camilo Mejia, the chair of the board of Iraq Veterans Against the War, a former staff sergeant and a conscientious objector.
Hello, everybody. My name is Brian Kassler. I served 4 years with 2nd Battalion, 6th Marines, Fox Company. We're an infantry unit. What I want to talk about is some of the smaller things that occurred very frequently throughout my 3 combat tours. These are the things that I left out to the letters home, and I rarely mention because it's not something I'm proud of. Whether I participated or I witnessed it, I never stopped it. When I first arrived at the fleet after completing infantry training, I checked into my unit, and we had our first company formation. This is something that I didn't think about until I had made friends with a few people in the unit, but our first platoon was a segregated platoon, and nearly 90% of all minorities in the company had been moved to first platoon, where white leaders were put in charge of those minorities as squad leaders and platoon sergeant. The real separation here is more than race. It's the dehumanization of individuals through devaluation of their worth. And in the Marine Corps, as an infantry unit, you separate yourself from everybody else by thinking of all other Marines as POGs, which are people other than grunts, and then yourself as infantry. And somehow you have more value than those other people. And this carries on to later stories. Just some common things that you'll face in your daily non-combat environment is if you're in an office and it's the morning and you're walking by maybe one of your staff sergeants and you say, "Good morning, staff sergeant." Well, I guess the common response in the civilian world would be like, "Well, good morning to you too." But in the Marine Corps, you get kill babies. And that's motivating. That's not meant to be funny, or that's meant to motivate you and, you know, start off your day with kill babies. And this isn't something that just happens once. The Marine Corps is filled with one-upsmanship, to say the most dehumanizing, the most racist, the most offensive thing, and to enjoy it while you're doing it. During my first deployment, I was deployed to Kuwait in support of the invasion of Iraq. This was in 2003. Our unit was responsible for guarding General Tommy Franks. While staged in Kuwait, we received alerts for incoming missiles or possible gas attacks. Well, as a Marine, being with the general, you feel like you're going to get the most current information and you're going to be protected because you're going to be just up to date and around these other important people. Well, it was very disheartening to see the generals, Marines running out of their tents, putting on their gas mask. And then I look over to our commanders and I say, well, should we put on our gas mask? They say, well, wait, the gas siren hasn't been sounded yet. And several minutes later, maybe 5-10 minutes, they would come running back out because they had forgotten to sound the siren for the rest of the base. So as Marines, we knew our place. We were at the bottom of the food chain. We were the ones that get forgotten about. Some of the other smaller things went into Iraq, and my experiences were mostly a positive reception by the Iraqi people. We were mostly vehicle-mounted and pushing forward. And when we weren't vehicle-mounted, we were in obscure bases that only a small amount of nomads would come by and interact with us. But while on these convoys, I saw Marines defecate into MRE bags and throw them at children on the side of the road, urinate into bottles, throw them at children on the side of the road. While stopped, take out their MRE bag, remove the chemical packaging that is activated by water, activated by moisture. This is what Marines use, all service members with MREs use to heat their MREs as a moisture-activated chemical heater. They would remove the chemical heater from the warning package that's a do not eat with a symbol of a person and a X sign through them saying, you know, do not eat this. And they would give that to Iraqi children to see the responses on their faces. Eventually, our last point of settling during the invasion was in Babylon. While there, I saw the destruction of the Babylonian ruins. I saw people take away chunks of it to bring it home. I saw the complete lack of understanding and just disrespect for the ruins, with people driving Humvees up slanted walls so they could drive the Humvees extremely fast down the walls to get a little joyride while nobody was around. Other things I experienced was I was on post one day, and I noticed all these MREs, but they were slightly different. They were bigger, and they were yellow. I didn't know what these were, and we hadn't been receiving food at the rate that we were consuming it. So we were at a ration level, and these MREs were just sitting in the open. So I go over there, and I grab one, and I give a few to my buddies, and I start to, you know, wonder about what these are. And as I'm eating it, I start reading, and these are humanitarian MREs that the Marines were keeping to feed themselves instead of giving to the Iraqi people that they were supposed to be sent to. We didn't have a clearly defined mission except keep pushing forward. And when you don't have a clearly defined mission, that mission just becomes to come home alive, to survive. And Marines will have nothing more than to do one thing, and that's to one-up each other by using their training. And when you become stagnant and the mission becomes survival, Marines are going to use their training on Marines around them or on the civilian population. I saw this happen countless times, that our training for protesters, violent situations were used on unsuspecting civilians because there were no rules. And this was perpetrated by squad leaders and platoon sergeants. And if anyone's going to charge you with anything, it's going to be them. And if they're doing it, then you know you can get away with it. And it happens. It happened all the time. During my second combat deployment, I was deployed to the United States Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan, from 2004 to 2005. This is not a normal role to guard an embassy as an infantry unit. This is usually carried out by Marine security guards, also known as MSG. At this point, I had been in the Marine Corps for a couple years, and it had become apparent that minorities in our unit, for whatever reasons they be, were not being promoted at the same rate as non-minorities. And the ones that did get promoted were exceptional. They would have been promoted no matter where they were because they went through meritorious boards. They were some of the brightest and best Marines I've ever worked with. However, while in Afghanistan, this was the point where we were told we were going to become leaders, that we were going to step up and start taking the leadership positions. Well, one of the first things we did as leaders is we had to go to a range. And to get to this range, we would drive in white vans. The area was not very unstable. These vans were not very secure vans. They were thin aluminum walls, and it was not meant to protect us. But the point of the matter is that we would be unsupervised because we were the leadership. You know, we were supposed to be the supervision. Well, this was more viewed as a time to have some fun with our unsupervision and, you know, do what boys do. So people who didn't even have licenses back in the States or know how to drive stick were now driving these vans through the crowded downtown streets of Kabul, Afghanistan, at extremely high speeds, at the fastest the vehicles would go, driving in oncoming traffic, driving between the two lanes, pushing vehicles out of the way. And on one occasion, a man was killed for coming through an intersection at speeding vehicles. He was hit by the vehicle. He was not shot. Our vehicle hit this man, and we kept driving. I do not know if his family received any reparations or any repayment from the U.S. government. At another time, one of the drivers without a license, while going through one of the main circles in the city, hit a man and his donkey on a cart. And, you know, we talk about it here. You take away something as simple as one vehicle or your donkey, that's an entire family's livelihood. And that family... That family could have been ruined by this small one incident. Finally, I'd like to talk about my third deployment, and that's to Iraq. Again, in 2005 to 2006, we were stationed in downtown Fallujah at the mayor's compound. Talking again about devaluation of Marines around you, we were told we would be receiving one sappy plate. That was because the Marine Corps couldn't afford back sappies. So it was my job to issue out these sappies. And every day people would ask me, where are the back sappies? And I would have to look them in the face and say that, well, the Marine Corps says we don't have enough money for back sappy plates right now. Another incident I saw in just the devaluation of life of other Marines was one Marine didn't have a gas mask the entire deployment. The rest of the company did, but this one Marine did not. And he repeatedly requested for a gas mask, and his requests were just ignored and pushed off to the side because the command did not like him. Now, I'm not saying there were chemical threats. I didn't experience any myself, but when the other 100-plus Marines are walking around 24/7 going to the bathroom with their gas mask, you kind of want one yourself. Just another little devaluation was the importance of documents in the mayor's compound to the Iraqi people. We had a couple of Marines that were being punished, and one of their punishments was to remove all this paperwork from the top floor of the mayor's compound and bring it down into our dumpsters while in full gear. This took hours for them to do, and I think it might have spanned across days, actually. Well, after all the paperwork was gone, I finally had a chance to sit down with my interpreter and just ask, you know, what was all that paperwork? Well, come to find out, we destroyed all the birth certificates of the city of Fallujah. I'd like to sum up what all my statements have to do with, and that's an undefined mission and a lack of positive peer pressure. Negative peer pressure is rampant in the Marine Corps. It's probably rampant throughout all the military, but it's especially rampant in the infantry and in the Marine Corps. And when you have neither of those, the only mission that a Marine infantryman knows by heart is the mission of a Marine Corps rifle squad. Locate, close with, and destroy the enemy by fire and maneuver, or to repel the enemy's assault by fire and close combat. And that's what you're going to do. You're going to use your training, and you're going to use that one mission that you know verbatim by heart with your eyes closed while you're asleep, and you dream about it, and you train every day, and you went through 3 months of boot camp and 3 months of infantry training, and you train between deployments and during deployments to carry out that mission. And when your mission's not defined, you're gonna use that one mission that you have defined, and you're going to use those skills that you have to handle hostile people, not friendly people, not people that are looking for your help or looking for your hand. You're going to use that training that you got. And it absolutely becomes that all you have is hammers, and everything you find is nails, and you're going to crush it. You're going to crush every nail that you find, and we're crushing the Iraqi people with the training we're giving and the unsupportive nature that's around us in the military. Thank you.
Former Marine infantryman Brian Kassler offer testimony here at Winter Soldier as part of the Racism and Dehumanization.
Pacifico Radio's Aaron Glantz will translate the statement of our final witness, Mohammed Amer, a resident of Adamiya, Iraq.
We're just preparing to watch a video of Iraqi testimony, and I will translate from the Arabic. Once in March of 2005, the man says, there were seven young men fighting in the U.S. forces, shooting them with mortars. On that day, the Americans prepared a trap for them, because they shot at them from the same place repeatedly. So they captured them and killed them. I saw them when we received the corpses in the Adamiya District Police Station. And they were mutilated. It was an after-death mutilation, stabbed and injured. Their delivery to the police station was really fast. They were killed at about 11 a.m., and we received them at 1 p.m., so it's impossible to be done by others. He's asked if he ever witnessed any civilians being tortured by the American military. I've never been arrested, he says. But once they attacked my house to arrest my little brother. That was on the 4th of April, 2007, at 2:30 in the morning. And it lasted until 5 in the morning. They attacked us in a very stressful way. They exploded the outer door with two bombs. Our wives and children were in bed. And we too were scared. They captured me, my father, and my brother. They wrapped up our hands to be sure that my hands turned blue. And they dislocated my shoulder. Then they started to beat us, accusing us of weapons possession, calling us terrorists. And then they took my brother and went away. Did they find any weapons? Is the question. No, not even a bullet. He's asked, have you ever been threatened with death or humiliation? Yes, my mother was holding a little bag, he says, containing all our possessions, about $13,000. They made her choose between raping our girls and giving the money away. So she was forced to give the money. And they also took all our cell phones. Our blankets and even our clothes. Who made this threat is the question.
The American soldier told the interpreter, and the interpreter told my parents, he says. They stayed from 2:30 in the morning until 5 in the morning. They used stress positions. The target was my little brother. When the accuser pointed at him, they started beating him. All the blood came out of his face, head, and every part of his body. He's asked if he was threatened. When they asked him about raping his girls, does he think they were serious about it? He says, "Allow me to ask you back. Did this happen before or not?" "We expect it to happen because it happened before and it may happen again," he says. "And who did it before was not even punished at all." "Like that little girl who was raped, killed, and burnt with her parents. So I was 90% sure they would do it. Because we didn't see any humanity in them, only cruelty." "Did they beat your father too?" "Yes, and he is 60 years old. And they beat him strongly." "And who stole the money?" "It was taken from my mother, received by the interpreter, handed to the American soldier." "Sure, my parents speak excellent English. And they told the general that it's our money." So he answered, "Choose between your money and your honor." So we brought out our honor with our money. That was the voice of Mohammed Amr, a resident of Adamiya in northern Baghdad.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle